I have a dream.
One small step.
Oh, my, what do you say?
The wall must go.
China, Princess of Wales.
Crashed into the World Trade Center.
Winner is Sydney.
This week in history.
This week, I'm taking you to the Red Center, where Uluru, well, it holds a very special place in Australia, and particularly in the hearts of the Anangu people, the traditional custodians of Uluru and Kutajuta. This week in 1975, 40 years ago, following decades of, well, 75, no, that's 50 years ago, following decades of determined advocacy by the Anangu people, the federal government handed back the title deeds to the national park where Uluru sits and returned the landmark to the care of its traditional owners. If you were there, I'd love to hear from you. Or if you've got a significant experience or memory to share at Uluru, I'd love to hear from you as well. 1-300-800-222 is the number to call. 1-300-800-222. Or the text line 0467-922-702. Well, John Paul Janke is the National Indigenous Affairs Editor at NITV and co-host of their flagship news and current affairs program, The Point. And I believe is at Uluru Kutajuta as well. JP, welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening. Good evening. Thanks for having me on. Yes, I am coming to you from the heart of the nation, from the centre of Australia, from the red dirt country, as you said, here for the 40th anniversary of the handback of Uluru Kutajuta to its traditional owners.
Yeah. What is it like there at the moment? Paint us a picture, JP.
It's hot. We had a couple of days of nice temperature, a bit of rain, but today it was hot, and you know that's what the Red Centre is. But it's been a weekend of celebrations. Of course, marking the 40th anniversary, but greater celebrations, I think, marking Anangu culture and celebrations all round of the 40th anniversary. So it's been a weekend of extreme weather, hot, lots of rain, but hot temperatures, but also of celebrations, and celebrations that land was returned 40 years ago to its traditional owners, but also it's been 40 years of joint management of Uluru Kutajuta between traditional owners and Parks Australia.
Yeah. So we'll get into what happened over this weekend in a moment, but take us back to how the handback came about, JP.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting story. Of course, the handback was the 26th of October, 1985, but the decision to hand back the Uluru and Kutajuta to traditional owners actually started 2 years earlier. The Hawke government, I think in November 1983, made the decision that they would hand back Uluru and Kutajuta after decades of lobbying by traditional owner groups and various land councils here in the centre to return this country to traditional owners. So I think in November 1983, Bob Hawke announced to the territory government that he was going to hand back the national park, Uluru Kutajuta, of course. So it took about 2 years for that process to happen, with a wider consultation with traditional owner groups of what that would actually look like, of then setting up a joint management committee, and then obviously leasing the park back to National Parks and Wildlife Service, as it was in those days, which became Parks Australia. Of course, the NT government was totally against the land being handed back to the Anangu people and the traditional owner groups. So they waged a campaign actually saying, you know, that Ayers Rock, as it was called back then, belongs to all Australians, that if it's handed back, it'll be locked away and all Australians wouldn't have access to it. And it got caught up in territory rights versus Commonwealth rights. So there was a bit of dispute between the territory government and the Commonwealth government. But of course, Bob Hawke overrode all that, and Sir Ninian Stevens on the 26th of October 1985 handed back the title deeds to the Anangu people. And he made a great line. He said, we might be in the middle of the continent, but we are at the heart of the nation. And even today, you can still feel that Uluru Kutajuta is at the heart of the nation.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, just how significant was this at the time, JP?
Very significant. It had come off decades of land rights and traditional owner groups and Aboriginal groups around Australia fighting for national land rights legislation. Of course, you had the Aboriginal 10 Embassy set up in 1972, which was really about Aboriginal rights, but really pushed the cause of Aboriginal land rights. You had Aboriginal land rights put into legislation in 1975 and 1976. So Uluru Catajuta was really the first iconic land to be handed back under that Commonwealth land rights system. So it was all about joint management. It was all about Aboriginal people having a say in their traditional lands, but importantly, getting land handed back to them. And one thing I didn't know, which I learned this week in researching for our program, The Point we're doing up here, is that a lot of traditional owner groups here were inspired by the Gurindji walk-off. The Gurindji walk-off from Wave Hill in the 1960s and the strike of the Gurindji and the eventual handback of that land after years of on strike by Whitlam. So they were inspired of that way of getting their land and their country back.
Yeah, gosh. And I don't think it would be the only event that was inspired by that walk-off either, JP. Now, this happened after a lot of work from the Anangu people, didn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. As I said, look, they had been moved off country ever since, I think, Europeans had discovered Central Australia. Of course, the hope was that this area would be large cattle stations. Of course, they weren't able to eventuate because of the climate and the heat, but people were moved off country. They were moved into missions and reserves. A lot of the people were spread into Western Australia, more regional NT, and of course South Australia, into the APY lands. So part of the process was people coming back to country, the Anangu coming back to country. So it was decades of lobbying that we were coming back to country and we wanted to be in control of our traditional lands again.
Mm. You're on ABC Radio. I'm James Finlay. This is Nightlife, and with you is John Paul Janke, the National Indigenous Affairs Editor at NITV. And this week in history, it's been 40 years since the Uluru Catajuta was handed back to traditional owners. JP Janke is with you from NITV's The Point, and you're hearing all about the handover that happened 40 years ago in 1985, this week, when the traditional owners, the Anangu traditional owners, the traditional custodians of Uluru and Catajuta had Uluru given back to them. Let's go to the phones, because I'd love to hear your memories of this, or your memories, significant memories of visiting Uluru as well. Let's go to Melbourne, where Elizabeth is. Elizabeth, you went in the 60s.
Let's go to the phone, because I'd love to hear your...
Oh, Elizabeth, I'll just get you to turn your radio down in the background for me. Let's try and get you again. Elizabeth?
Well, let's go to Melbourne, where Elizabeth is. Elizabeth, you went...
Elizabeth?
Yes.
Yes.
I went years ago in 1968. There were four of us who we bought a VW station wagon, and in those days the road was unsealed after Port Augusta, and there was a sign saying next petrol 450 miles. So we had to carry petrol. And we had one of us had to clean the air filter every night. But anyway, I'll never forget the extraordinary sight of, after days and days of driving in the heat because it was Christmas time and very hot, and suddenly this very, very flat land, and here was this enormous thing on the horizon, and that was Uluru. And when we got there, there was a sort of lean-to hotel, and in it were cartoons of how they thought the future would be, and they had hotels, you know, four stories high and heaps of tourists. And of course, in a way, that actually happened later.
Yeah, wow. What was it like when you were there? It sounds like it was quite an experience that you still remember very vividly, Elizabeth.
Oh, it is. It was unforgettable. And we walked around the whole rock and saw that it had, you know, fissures and that had been made by erosion. And in those days, the Aboriginal people didn't have control over the rock, nor did we know that for them it was sacred and that you shouldn't walk on it.
Mm.
And we're very sympathetic. And, you know, I was for years in a group that fought for rights for Aborigines. And I was horrified to discover that we shouldn't have walked on it at all.
Mm.
But it was a wonderful experience, and I think it's very different if you fly in and stay in a posh hotel rather than going to it in a very difficult way.
Yes. Well, did you ever go back again after 68, Elizabeth?
No, I haven't been back.
Because I'd imagine the road is probably a little bit more sealed and maybe a few more fuel stations than it was in 68, Elizabeth.
It's completely sealed, I know, because people have told me.
Yeah. Oh, thank you so much for sharing your visit there, Elizabeth.
Not at all. Bye.
Elizabeth there in Melbourne. I'll get to more of your calls very shortly. 1-300-800-222. Love to hear your memories of visiting Uluru. JP Janke is with you, the National Indigenous Affairs Editor at NITV. And there are quite a few significant stories and traditions that surround Uluru, aren't there, JP?
Yeah, look, for a lot of First Nations people around Australia, song lines connect the different nations. Uluru connects the majority of First Nations around this country. So a lot of First Nations communities have a connection to Uluru, and it is a place. It's a sacred place. And I think Elizabeth is spot on. You know, a long time ago, you could camp at the base of Uluru. There was a hotel, there was a campground, there was an airfield right up almost against the rock.
Oh, wow.
And people came here from all around Australia and they camped right at the base of Uluru. I had the opportunity this weekend to talk to Shane Howard from Goanna Band, who was up here as part of the celebrations and performed at the concert last night, who sang, of course, Solid Rock. And I got the opportunity to ask him about why he wrote that song and how he wrote that song. And his experience was the same as Elizabeth. He said he came up here, he camped at the base of Uluru, and he was just in awe of this mighty geographical landscape in the middle of Australia. And he says, you know, the opening line of the song, out here nothing changes, not in a hurry anyway. You can feel the endlessness, the coming of the light of day. And that's what you feel when you come out here. And to all your listeners who haven't been out here, you'll get what Elizabeth said, that you can see it in a distance, but then you get right up to it on the road, on the sealed road now, and it takes your breath away. The size of it and the majesty of it and the sacredness of it just takes your breath away. And last night, Shane Howard performed Solid Rock, and I think people were very emotional just hearing that song and seeing Uluru in the background and just feeling the sacredness and the ancient history of this country was something very special.
Yeah. Let's go to Melbourne now where Michael is. Michael, tell us about your visit.
How you going, all right?
Yeah, good. Thanks, Michael.
Yeah, Hard to beat what Elizabeth said, but I was there in, I went up in 1980 with a school camp, and just amazing, just incredible. The roads were still unsealed. We did a bus tour, yeah, and it was like, it was the as far as I can remember, it was just dirt roads for days. We climbed it unaware that, you know, that wasn't kosher, but, you know, back in the day, that was what it was. And camping, your guest said, oh, you know, come up now and have a look at it and you'll experience what Elizabeth experienced. You won't, because it's all built up. It's bitumen roads and hotels and everything. Back then, there was none of that. And I remember, similar to what Elizabeth said, where you came in and there's just this in the landscape. Mm. And we camped right on the base of the, pretty much on the base of the rock. And there was as I remember, there was a shop. And that was where you'd get your, we could go and buy stuff from there. And the Aboriginals, they were hanging around there, and they'd even exchange stuff with us. I got a woomera off one of the Aboriginals for a T-shirt.
Yeah, right. How important was it for you to visit, Michael?
Well, it wasn't, but I did it as a school camp, and it's indelibly stamped in my head.
Yeah,
in my mind, the rock and watching it change colour. I've not been back, and sometimes I'd like to, but I have such a beautiful memory of it. I don't know if I want to distort that by going back.
Yeah, that's totally understandable. Thank you, Michael, for your call.
But just an incredible, you know, like I say, I don't think the experience now would be the same as what it was when I did it, or Elizabeth did it 12 years prior to me.
Yeah.
Just unbelievable.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Michael. Michael in Melbourne there, 1-300-800-222. JP, just how, take us back to when the change happened where you couldn't climb on the rock anymore, because that would have been incredibly important and significant for the Anangu people.
Yeah, look, it was part of the joint management, I suppose, is the big fear from the Northern Territory government was that if the land was handed back, that the park could be closed and Uluru would be cut off. So there was an agreement that they would keep access to Uluru for all Australians and revisit that every decade. So in 2010, the traditional owners looked at a pathway to closing the climb. And Uluru has always been sacred to various groups in Central Australia. But they allowed people to climb. They decided in 2010 to look at a pathway to close the climb, noting that people still wanted to climb. There's lots of issues, the sacredness of Uluru, but also the dangers of Uluru. It's a dangerous climb. And I think back in those days, when your guests were talking about it, it was really dangerous, but people still climbed it. You know, there was just a chain up a very steep climb.
Mm.
People died. And I think somewhere in the vicinity of 50 people had died climbing Uluru. So traditional owners feel very sorry. And they now call the closure, where you can see the pathway with the old climb, they call that a sorry trail, because people have died there. So they feel that. They feel the responsibility when people die on their country. So they did a pathway to saying, if the number of people climbing the rock, climbing Uluru, got below a certain number, that we would close the climb. And that didn't happen for 9 years. So it wasn't until 2019 that the rock climb was closed permanently.
Wow. Because, that really wasn't long ago at all.
Yeah, not long ago. So, and what they're saying is, still come out here, still experience the beauty and majestic nature of this country. You've got Uluru Katajuta, but please respect our wishes not to climb. And people are still coming out here and experiencing wonderful different ways of engaging with such sacred, a beautiful country.
Mm. Let's go to Blackburn, where David is, 1-300-800-222. David, you visited in, gosh, 1958. Tell us about
1958. That's right. Yes.
Tell us about your visit.
Just a mate and I in an ordinary Holden car. We were on a camping trip and we were heading for Alice Springs, but we thought we'd deviate for 2 or 3 days to have a look at Ayers Rock, as it was then known to me anyway. And we were lucky because we were there after good rain. The desert along the road was just a blaze of everlasting flowers. When we reached the rock, we were lucky because the rain had created 2 very nice pools at the base of the rock. That would have been on the western side, I think. We swam in one and we used the other for drinking water. There was no one around to tell us we shouldn't or should or couldn't. We drove around the rock twice. We were young and fit and quite determined to climb it. But there was no instruction to say, climb here or start here.
Oh, gosh.
So we drove around it twice and we thought, well, you know, there's probably not another living human for maybe hundreds of kilometres or miles in those days. So we thought, well, if we could climb it and get into trouble, we've only got ourselves to blame. So we didn't climb it. And that's how I remember it. And gosh, I've never been back since.
Wow. Well, especially after what JP was saying about the amount of people that died climbing it, it's maybe lucky you didn't if that were that many people.
It could be. Well, we had no guideline to what we should do or could do or couldn't do or shouldn't do.
Yeah.
But it was just the absolute isolation. And from the time we left the north-south road, Port Augusta to Alice Springs, and turned west, we never saw another living human for 3 days.
Yeah, wow.
Interesting, and that's how I remember it, and I think it's probably how I would prefer to remember it.
Yes, well, and look, not many people would have those memories, you know, compared to the tourists that visit these days, David. So it sounds like you really got to capture a unique experience there.
I remember it very vividly. I'm well over 90 now, well into my 90s, and it was just a sort of a highlight of the camping trip, but we didn't realise at the time that it was going to be anything unusual in retrospect.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, gosh. David, thank you so much for the call. It's incredible to hear what the experience was like in 58.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
David in Blackburn there. You're on ABC Radio. I'm James Finlay. With you is John Paul Janke from NITV. And in just a moment, we'll hear what happened over the weekend and get to more of your stories as well. Then the line to call 1-300-800-222 or the text line 0467-922-702.
Worms, slime, and the secrets of the plant world.
Costa!
The Gardening Australia Junior podcast has brand new adventures for little ears.
Cool.
Search for it now on the ABC Listen app.
On ABC Radio, this is Nightlife with James Finlay.
And I'll take you to the top end in about 15 minutes' time to get the latest in rural news. I'll get to more of your memories in just a moment too, but John Paul Janke is with you, the co-host of NITV's The Point. And JP, look, a big weekend. The PM and the Governor-General were there alongside traditional custodians. We're at, 40 years now. How are relations between traditional owners and the government now at Uluru?
Yes, it was a big event this weekend, I think. It's celebrating not only 40 years of the handback, but 40 years of the park being jointly managed. So Indigenous people, traditional owner groups, having a say in their own country. Look, I think the relationship over many years has developed to a point where it is truly celebrated that I think traditional owner groups feel as though they have real strength in the partnership with Parks Australia. We saw over the weekend, you know, a great celebration to have a Prime Minister here, to have the Governor General here, to have, you know, Minister for the Environment Murray Watt here, Northern Territory politicians. There were chairs of other major Indigenous sort of national park management committees all around the country that were here. So it was really a celebration of 40 years of joint management and what 40 years has brought to tourist owner groups in the way that they can manage and sustain their own country. The big fear campaign 40 years ago was the park would be completely shut off to all Australians. That never eventuated. And in fact, what's happened is the park now is really celebrated as a symbol of what can happen when you celebrate Indigenous culture, but you give First Nations people a say on the management of their own country, because they've lived on this country for thousands of generations, and they want to see this country here for thousands more generations.
Mm. Well, no doubt you've got some things coming up on NITV for us to check out. Where can we see it, and what have you got in store for us on the telly, JP?
Well, we've been up here filming a show, so in early November we will have a wrap-up show about the celebrations up here, the success of joint management, but also the opportunities up here for other First Nations group, of course. Your viewers were telling great stories about the old days when they could camp at the base of Uluru, and I take my hat off to them. I was up here today and it was 33 degrees. it was hot, and I can only imagine camping in a tent, being in an old Holden with no air conditioning.
Yes. On the dirt road.
Driving on the dirt road. They deserve a medal. But they all, I think what I heard from them is the beauty that they saw when they got up here. And when you get up here, you see Uluru in one frame, and you turn right and you see Catajuta, the Olgas, in the other, and you realise how beautiful this continent is. And I always come up here and I go, I celebrate that, you know, Australia is the oldest continent in the world. You know, we are a magnificent country, and that's something that all Australians should celebrate.
Yeah. It's, look, I haven't been to Uluru yet, but I get a sense of it when I visit Kakadu. Just it's like you've stepped into another world.
Yeah, absolutely. And your listeners said it. There's nothing around. There's nothing else around. And all of a sudden you come across this monolith of Uluru, and you can see in the distance Catajuta, which means many heads in Anangu language, and it's just spectacular. Mm-hmm. It honestly takes your breath away, and I always think that all Australians should make a pilgrimage to here to really celebrate how ancient this continent is.
Yeah. Look, JP, it's always great to chat. Thank you so much for taking the time out to spend with us on Nightlife, and we'll talk to you again very soon.
Thanks very much.
John Paul Janke there. He's the National Indigenous Affairs Editor at NITV and host of the flagship news and current affairs program, The Point.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.